Previously on Graphic Novelism.
Now, elevator go up, elevator go down.
I watched, over the past month, literally every single episode.
What?
No! No! Wow!
Are you kidding me?
I'm wearing the animated series Joker shirt as we're recording this. This wasn't planned!
Yes, Luke Skywalker, I'm sure you do an amazing Joker. Get out of here.
It's always weirdly specific and filled with useless detail.
And Elvira.
I'm a graphic novelism where comic culture is vivisected by experts on nothing real. I'm your host, Aristocrat Alex Cook.
I am Jammin' James Lewis.
And I'm Maniacal Mike Napier.
The first part of Graphic Novelism's retrospective on the groundbreaking Batman the Animated Series, we spent a lot of time discussing the show's various stages of origin, its initial conception at Warner Brothers Animation in 1990, the eventual hiring of Bruce Timm and Eric Radomski as showrunners, the early but vital contributions made by series staples Paul Dini and Alan Burnett, and a general host of information that paved the way for the eventual series premiere on September 5th, 1992. But as we discussed these topics, it became increasingly clear to all three of us that in order to talk about this show, which serves as a landmark in both superhero fiction and serialized storytelling in a medium that had often been dismissed, that one part simply wouldn't be enough to convey the sheer impact that the show eventually made on fans, storytellers, and an industry that would be forced to step up in meeting the audience's demands. In live-action film and television before it, animation was a medium shaped by moments of evolution. Those moments would become more isolated as time went on for the sheer ingenuity required to bring the cartoon world out of its more traditional stylings. The eureka moment that would become more rarely seen as with evolution in a genre, lessons that need to be learned are learned and become wider spread amongst properties that take those lessons to heart and apply them. And Batman the Animated Series was nothing if not a lesson. A broad statement of how to adapt these larger-than-life, modernized, mythological figures that intelligently, compassionately, and perhaps most importantly of all, to an audience as diverse as possible so that it could properly stand the test of time. The main reason behind Batman the Animated Series' success, and indeed the reason we still find new ways to talk about its legacy 25 years later, is because of the key strategy employed by Timm and Radomski from the beginning. Tell a series of stories that never talk down to its audience. Batman is a seminal figure in pop culture, and never more so than today. He's a character that's endured nearly 80 years of constant and drastic change through a variable of lenses. He's one of the most palpable superheroes in fiction because of his leaning towards the world around him. As a result of this, he has a fan base that can literally span across any age. From young children who are just learning how to form their own understanding of the world around them, to seasoned adults who look for a form of escapism that speaks to them. Cape Crusader acts as a universal avatar that breaks barriers that few fictional characters can. And the animated series knew that. And more importantly, they understood that possibly even more than any other media adaptation of the character that has ever existed. Going into part two of this, we're moving away from the origins of the show and getting into the real meat of the conversation. What the animated series did right, what it did wrong, and perhaps most interestingly of all, what it left behind in its wake whenever the series run came to an end in the fall of 1995. But to start things off, I'd like to begin this episode by taking my co-hosts on a brief tangent of nostalgia that will pull us right back into the mindset when we were alive at the time of the series airing. We'll talk about an element of the show that is both vital to understanding its popularity and integral to realizing just what priorities were getting children hooked into the series as a whole. Gentlemen, I'd like to quite literally talk about those wonderful toys.
It's Batman!
Two-Face is on a firing frenzy!
Charging into action, it's Combat Belt Batman!
You just got on my bad side, Batman! Tough luck!
Great save!
Oh no!
Robin swoops down in his parry.
Fire!
A narrow miss! The eyes of justice are watching! It's Batman in the invincible hoverbat. No contest.
Capture Claw.
Two-Face is off to serve double time. The eyes of justice. Batman.
Batman the Animated Series pioneered the model of the oversaturated action figure market. Because it had so many characters, because it had so many other things going for it beyond even like a G.I. Joe, because they were created characters, but you had Batman movies that came out and had action figure lines, but you didn't have the sheer scope. You didn't have all of these drastic characters that would come out. So there was a high demand based on Fox Kids' need for this to create just action figure after action figure after action figure and vehicles and accessories and everything that we would come to associate with action figures and marketing, really, in the 1990s.
Oh, in the history of action figures, there's Star Wars and then Batman in the 90s. Those were the two tent poles of America.
Laser ski, yeah. Batman.
Oh, that's what I was going to get to, is that because there was such a demand, a high demand, and there was a huge demand from parents and kids and just everyone who wanted a piece of this, the animated series brought about just this sense of, we need a nostalgia overload to happen right now. So in doing this, they created figures like Skydive Batman, which is an orange Batman who has a metal aluminum foil parachute that comes out of a oversized backpack. I had this figure when I was a kid. There's Infrared Batman, who is red and has a giant, like, bubble over his head and shoots discs. There's a Bruce Wayne figure that has, like, little clip-on pieces of the armor that you can turn into Batman. And then there's the villains. You have all the villains with Catwoman, Man-Bat, Joker. There's a ninja variant of Robin.
As a kid, I was always so jealous of the kids who were able to have just a regular Batman figure, because I only had the stupid neon ones.
The closest I got was a normal Batman figure, but he was red. So
I think
that
I
was
had
confusing.
That one too.
Yeah.
And also there was the one of my favorites, which is Nightstar Batman, who he's gold, but he has black pieces over him. Because he didn't need to be too confusing.
I had a Batman who rode in a mechanical dragon.
I think I know which figure you're talking about, actually.
There was a whole
That's
line.
Culturally
yeah.
insensitive.
He oh, yeah, rode like in a mechanical dragon.
That was like the Crime Squad line, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah. There was a lot of knights. A lot of knights.
Yeah, like, there was and they had like the Bat Cycle and... James, I know you particularly had a fondness for the Batplane.
Oh, that is when you look at the earliest known footage of James Lewis on the surf, like, you see me holding the Batman the Animated Series Batplane and smiling. And that's not even to talk about the Burger King toys.
Small correction, it was the McDonald's toys.
Ah, even better. Because let me tell you, for the folks at home that are a little younger than us and don't remember the glory day of the Happy Meal, in the early 90s, Happy Meal toys were just real toys. Like, you just got an action figure with your food.
Mm-hmm.
You got an action figure, or you got a vehicle that would actually run. Now, sometimes you would have like a twist tie type thing that you would have to put into it and then pull, and it would go a little ways. And they've kind of stuck to that because the quality has gone down. But back in the day, these things were, especially when you're a kid, they were huge. They were like on the level of the actual toy line itself.
Yeah, the Catwoman action figure I got with my Happy Meal as a four-year-old was just my Catwoman action figure.
I went through several iterations of the Batman figure because I think I overplayed with them because I just, the paint would chip off and everything. That was the thing with these figures too, is that they were well crafted, but they were also very much of a production line. So Batman's symbol would just completely chip off within the year that I got.
Oh, I was about to say, that's the mark of achievement whenever you were a kid, when you finally thumb the bat symbol off of your Batman. It's like, oh, that's a notch in your belt there.
My earliest figure, actually, from this line, you were talking about the figure that you were jealous of because it was the normal Batman. That was Combat Belt Batman, which was one of the rarest figures of the entire line. That was my first action figure ever. And I'm not going to say that that informed my fandom of Batman, but it certainly didn't hurt, because that figure had it had the belt, it had the gadgets, it had everything, and it was the normal colors.
God, you were just a perfect storm of fandom. It's like you were built in a lab to be the ultimate Batman fan.
And then I chewed the ears off the figure because I was like four.
Good.
And that's why you prefer the Jim Lee cowl.
I mean, it's true. It reminds me of those days when I would just nibble on the plastic.
Oh, Batman tastes so good.
The entire reason I bring up the toy line and wanted to bring us back to this area of nostalgia is because in the fall of 1992, going into 1993, whenever the series was originally airing, Paul Dini actually had that very same nostalgia as we did. He had just gotten back from a promotion tour in Japan, and he brought with him this giant box of just Batman the Animated Series merchandise for everyone. And he kept passing them out. It's like, do you want this Riddler soap? It has a molded Riddler. It has a molded Riddler head on top of it. And Bruce Timm and the other people will be like, "Hey, thanks. You can keep it." But that was just kind of what the air around the production of the series was. It was just about, "Hey, we're creating this thing and getting crazy benefits off of it, and we're just happy to be alive because this is the dream project." Everyone who worked on that show was working on a dream collaboration because they were getting to do Batman with virtually no restraints, but at the same time, a ton of restraints that they would not really recognize until about the second season. As we talked about in the last episode, Fox would go a little Robin crazy and start demanding that he be in every episode. But what's fascinating about this time in the series production is that as they found their voice, they found out what worked. And one of the things that really worked, and this came to me actually after the last episode was put up in celebration of the 25th anniversary, Hollywood Reporter ran an article on the animated series and the impact that it had and the little anecdotes behind the scenes that you wouldn't really find anywhere else because they interviewed the actual actors and people that were there. And John Glover told a really cool story about how Andre Romano's entire philosophy to recording those shows was, you're doing a stage play. You're not doing just a cartoon animated show. You're doing something to where you come in, and they play, like, if you're a recurring guest star, they play your previous episode for the entire cast so they can know, okay, this is the mindset that we're supposed to be in. This is what our characters are doing. This is the motivations. And then you go off and various actors, pretty much the entire cast appearing in the show, sit in booths that are just side by side, but often like in a circle or something like that. And they would feed off of each other's energy. They staged these as if they were live action productions. And that's the reason that you get the performances that you do in the show. That's the reason that Batman has such a rapport with like Commissioner Gordon, with Alfred, with everyone, because he's actually interacting with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. in the booth, or Mark Hamill as the Joker, who had to stand up because he was so animated in the role. And it's so amazingly cool that that was a thing that happened, because that was just kind of rare for animation, especially at the time when everyone was just kind of used to, okay, you come in, you do your lines, you get out. And that kind of mentality was just kind of the norm. But
you don't even see that today at all.
Batman the Animated Series took a credo early on, and this informed kind of everything that would come later on. They weren't really going to tell stories that were just stories. They were going to tell mini-movies. Eric Radomski and Bruce Timm specifically go back to the idea of mini-movies because they wanted story and supplemental material that would support just doing their own versions of, okay, what's a comic book like? Okay, it's a theatrical narrative. It's moved towards a theatrical narrative. Okay, so what do we do for the series? Well, we'll do it in sort of three acts, like a three-act structure for a movie, but we'll condense that to 22 minutes. And when you watch the episodes, you actually see there is a three-act structure behind all of them. There is a three-act structure in the way that they come out and the way that they are produced that kind of elevates everything because there's something that you can follow and that you intricately understand, even as a kid, because the series is so intricately interwoven that you kind of realize they're not just having action scenes for the sake of it. They're actually telling stories. They're being mature about this, and they're actually doing it intelligently. And they're treating the characters seriously, and they're doing all the stuff that the series would come lauded for, of course, 25 years later even. But it's just so cool that a big part of what made this series was just the idea of, we have the best job in the world. Let's not take this for granted at all. And let's just go into this and make the best Batman show that we possibly can. Because that was the thing that Jean McCurdy told Bruce Timm. She said that you're going to do this, but you're going to do this as your Batman show. You're going to do this as the Batman show that you always wanted to see, because we want something that's passionate for the material. We don't want to see something that's just a cheap cash-in, because this is in the heyday of James Bond Jr. and the RoboCop animated series, and they were still finding their footing with real Ghostbusters and later on Extreme Ghostbusters, which would actually be more akin to Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, very much so.
But the idea behind the show and its various characters, going off of the mini-movies idea, some characters were more appropriate than others. The last time we actually were talking about the series, in the last episode, we were talking about various characters and the approach to them before we eventually ran out of time. We had talked about Two-Face, we talked about the approach to Mr. Freeze and the entire creation process behind him. One character, for a couple different reasons that I'll get into, didn't quite land and mesh with the creative team the way that all the other big staples of Batman lore would, and even their own creations like Harley Quinn and Baby Doll and all these other characters that would kind of go on to be beloved in their own way. Bane was a character that had been introduced a couple of years prior in Vengeance of Bane by Chuck Dixon. He was introduced to spearhead the Nightfall storyline in the comic books, which had just ended by the time that the series was really in the throes of production to where they would even warrant an appearance by Bane. So whenever they came up that they wanted to do Bane as a show, it was actually Mitch Bryan's idea. Mitch Bryan was the guy who helped Paul Dini and Bruce Timm do the series Bible, and he was the guy who wrote On Leather Wings. So he came up with the tall play for the Bane episode, which basically roughly adapts the Nightfall storyline in the loosest sense of the word. It's just basically, okay, this thing happens and this thing happens and this thing happens, go. No one liked Bane. No one on the series staff really liked Bane because, and this is kind of something that I think is easy to explain when you consider the context of the 90s, Doomsday had just come and gone. He was a character who was promised to be this big thing that Superman would have to deal with for the rest of his days and would be a lingering force within the canon. And then he's killed. Doomsday was the ultimate gimmick character. And with him was a herald of other gimmick characters that no one had any expectations for. Bane was very much seen as, oh, he'll be gone. He'll be forgotten in a couple of years. And Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and all of them just basically said, okay, we'll do him as a one-off. That's all we're giving him because he's not going to be around in the next couple of years. It's going to be even laughable to us a couple of years from now because we're going to look back on this and it's like, we gave an episode to the Bane guy? He's a dude on steroids. Like, what would he have to really bring to the show? So they intentionally had it to where he gets beaten by Batman. And he gets beaten not only in the most ridiculous way imaginable, but he gets unmasked and his face is revealed to be the most intentionally designed, pathetic person that you could ever see. Like, this is an actual production note because they legitimately just despise the idea of having to do a Bane episode because, oh, this one note thing that's just going to be forgotten in a couple of years, this thing that would never warrant anything whatsoever.
Well, it makes a lot of sense whenever you look at their whole philosophy on the atmosphere of the show. Like, from beginning to end, Batman the Animated Series was designed to be timeless, but you do not get a more 90s character than Bane, except for Doomsday. I imagine that they were very frustrated with the idea of even adapting like that big of an anachronism into their shows. Like, even if they wanted to do Bane, I imagine like there was the translation would be extremely difficult there.
Well, it's also very difficult in terms of this is supposed to be a noir and we have villains that are outlandish, but they're outlandish in very specific, quirky ways. So how is this Spanish strongman essentially going to fit into this world without just being this huge caricature of himself? And that's very much how he's played, even though I do love the Bane episode because it gets a lot right, despite the fact that everyone kind of went into it resenting him. Because it's just kind of everything that's on the page. It's the idea of, okay, this is character that has studied Batman from the beginning. There's this character that broke out after an experiment in Pinaduro. He came to Gotham City and wanted to take out Batman for the sole reason of becoming king of Gotham and displacing him and dispatching him from the echelon of criminals. So Bane, as a character, was simplistic enough to work as a one-off show. He was a one-off series episode, but at the same time, he presented a whole host of problems because, for one thing, they looked at the costume and they were like, you're not going to be able to tell what he's saying or doing or thinking in any moment because he has a mask that literally covers his entire face. So Bruce Timm, in a moment of weird inspiration, went to the Fourth World comics by Jack Kirby.
Oh, my God.
They went to Mr. Miracle and basically said, okay, let's adapt some elements. And I want you to take a look at those pictures right now and just imagine Jack Kirby whenever Bruce Timm is drawing those images, because that is what they did. Because you
That's
even
all at, I can see now, yep.
You even look at Bane's little tube that delivers the venom. That's based on the Mother Box.
Oh, my God.
Look at the belt.
Yep.
And the panties he's apparently wearing. Yeah, that's one of the Hunger Dogs.
That's basically a parademon without wings and without armor.
Also, so, I would like to say I really wish Bane looked this good in the episode.
Yeah, Bane, he kind of suffers from a bit of, whenever the original character designs would be designed, there would be a process of streamlining by the animators that would essentially make those characters even more simplistic, because that was just how animation had to work. And one thing that's really important to note about Batman, the Animated Series Season 2, is that it was a season pickup, and Fox did not want to give them money. Fox was very adamant about, okay, the marketing just kind of sells the series itself, so we want to devote even more money to the marketing. We want to sell even more toys. So there was a second version of the toy line put out that was the Crime Squad, as I said before.
Every action figure is Bane.
There was actually a second Bane. There was it was the same Bane figure, but it was put in new packaging for The Adventures of Batman and Robin.
How exciting.
It was insane.
So, Neon Street Luge Bane. Impossible.
So for the series, they got a serious downgrade in terms of the budget that they were working with. So much so that, you remember last episode when I mentioned the fact that Sunrise and Acom and all these other production studios were working overseas to bring the animation to life? Yet the bottom half of the animated series was handled exclusively by one studio, Dongyang Animation. And Dongyang is, in terms of the track record of all the animation studios that go into the production of Batman the Animated Series, they're not bad. They handle the majority of the episodes, so they have some really, really good ones. And then they have some not so great ones. They never really exceed to the level of just flat out terrible. But at the same time, there's some episodes that are wonkier than others. There are some episodes that are clearly rushed. There are episodes where the character models just randomly decide that they're not going to look correct for the entirety of the episode. Like, there's actually an episode called Blind as a Bat, which you might remember as the episode where the Penguin steals a chopper and blinds Batman in a random explosion. Well, the entirety of that episode is basically a series of video game cutscenes, as opposed to the traditional animated style, because there was actually a video game created that used original animated sequences from the animated series that was handled by Dongyang. And this is commonly referred to as the lost episode of Batman the Animated Series, because it was for the Sega CD, I believe. And it features just this kind of generic plot, and it features all the voice actors, like everyone from Hamill to Arlene Sorkin to John Glover as Riddler, Conroy, and Lauren Lester, of course. But this episode basically began a precedent that bled into the show, and that was Blind as a Bat, because that episode is one of the weirdest animated episodes of all time, because it just is so odd. I can't even describe how it looks. It looks like Batman Animated Series, but for an even younger audience, essentially, because the finances were just so stripped for it. And because of what happened, because of the fact that there was less money to work with, Batman the Animated Series essentially had to cope by using characters that they wouldn't like. Bane was also really brought in because he was a simple character to do. Like, there's really no kinder way to put that other than he was a guy that could supplement like a couple fight scenes. And we don't really have to put that much thought into the actual plotting of the episode or anything like that. So that really is just kind of the mentality of why they brought Bane into the series is, okay, well, there's this guy that we can use, but at the same time, we're just, this is completely out of character for the series. So much so that later on, whenever they decide to do the new adventures, they kind of took a different approach to it because Bane had been around for a while in the comic books. He'd come back in the Legacy storyline. He had done a couple of other things here and there, and he was slated to be in the next Batman movie, as announced in the trades. Tim, Dini, and Burnett, they all had a change of heart where they were like, okay, we were wrong. Bane is a character that is going to stand the test of time and probably be around forever and probably be used in a couple of other big things, so we're going to use him for all he's worth. They designed him after the Gimp in Pulp Fiction.
Wait.
For real?
Wait, they actually, that's not a joke? They actually did that?
In the commentary for Over the Edge, Bruce Timm refers to Bane as a leather boy.
So I've been calling him Leather Daddy Bane all these years, and I was half a word off.
I thought it was just a coincidence because old men did it.
Here's the thing. They wanted Bane to be as terrifying as humanly possible because they felt like they had to overcompensate for the fact that they really felt as if they had screwed the pooch and done a disservice to the character beforehand. So in order to bring him back for this big return, like Over the Edge is one of the greatest episodes of the entire run of the series. It's my personal favorite episode. And it had to have this big impact. You know, the end of the episode, there's this big villain that comes in and it's Bane. So they had to have this design with it that would make him the scariest looking character on the show. And for some reason in their minds, that equated to, well, what's the scariest character you can think of? The Gimp from Pulp Fiction?
I mean, not wrong.
What I love about Bruce Timm is that he always has to sex his way out of a creative problem. How do I make this character terrifying? I know. He'll be sexually terrifying.
And even in the Over the Edge commentary, which was recorded, by the way, in 2004 for the release on DVD of all the animated series, they're the versions that you can buy now. They're still in print. And in the commentary, he actually goes out of his way to say, like, Bane, to me, he looks very scary, looks very, like, intimidating. Like, we gave him all these spikes, and there's no hint of irony at all.
I mean, I wouldn't like my daughter dating him.
I mean, I can't say Bane doesn't look better.
He looks more Bane-ish. In that he's less Lucha, more like he's more a supervillain. But at the same time, Bane is a very Lucha looking character. So it's also a deviation in a weird way.
Also, he still kind of just looks like a parademon.
He looks like a Gimp parademon. Yeah.
Well, specifically, he looks like the parademons that they designed for Superman, the animated series, because that was a big thing with the redesigns of the New Adventures, which we'll get into later, is that they were done to supplement the Superman animated series because they had moved on to Superman after Batman, the animated series original run. So all of the characters were designed with that in mind after Superman had been on for a while. So Bane just kind of gets the leftovers of the parademon designs that they were doing for the Apocalypse Now two-parter. And because of that, he is a leather boy.
A para-leather boy.
What amuses me is their lack of care in writing Bane for the original episode aside. It's really interesting how they put in the work to make Bane fit the tone of Batman the Animated Series. That episode has a great tone, and the character of Bane in that episode has a great tone. Even if, I mean, I love that episode, but it's clearly written as we don't care. And then you get to Bane in New Adventures, where that tone is completely thrown out, and he looks like a gimp. And that has to be the weirdest Bane ever. Like, I like Bane in New Adventures. I mean, he's pretty much just muscle, but it's like, how'd you go from there to there? Like, what? I want to see something that's in between a little bit.
I mean, Mike, what more do you expect from a killer of children?
Well, that's the weird thing is that for Over the Edge, you can really look at that episode just as the writing for Bane. Not the design, not the anime, like nothing as far as that goes, just the writing purely. That is one of the single best Bane moments of anything, the comics, the films, anything. Oh, yeah. Bane in that episode is pure, unadulterated, epic in the way that he just flat out has the knuckle dragging fight with Batman that every criminal wishes he could have. And it's so weird that Paul Dini would then go on to write the Arkham game and have him be mildly retarded.
Bruh. Paul Dini does not like that.
Paul Dini just completely buys into the idea that he's just this dude who just takes steroids and that's all he does. Bane, as a big character moment in the comics, swore off Venom in like the mid-90s. He really didn't use it again until actually the late run of Secret Six, which was 2009. Bane was a character who relied solely and was really evolved into a character who relied solely on his will to do what he could, much in the same way of Batman, because it's supposed to be a Batman analog. Someone who also gets his way to becoming the pinnacle of human perfection, but with more monetary gain and more just nefarious intentions.
Like we said in the Born to Hate episode, Bane is the ultimate criticism of Batman as a tactician. Bane is just combat Batman who just cares about victory at all costs. He's essentially Worf from Star Trek The Next Generation transplanted into the Batman universe.
Now, let's think about this for a second. Paul Dini doesn't like Bane, but based on Over the Edge, you know who does like Bane? Barbara Gordon. She apparently thinks really the world weird. Of Bane.
She thinks Bane is the scariest villain they've ever come across. She buys into the whole leather daddy equals terror thing.
And she's still, in her head script, took the time to write out that Bane would disapprove of Batman training her as a successor because it was dishonorable.
Wait a minute. Let's see. Leather Daddy Bane is designed by Bruce Timm. Barbara having respect for Bane and Bane going after Batman because of what happened to Barbara. Wait a minute. God damn it, Bruce Timm. God damn it. Stay away from... She's a child.
You take your leering eyes away from her.
Is this why Paul Dini doesn't talk to you anymore? Because of Bane?
But just in terms of villains that just don't work, Bane probably takes the cake. And not in terms of villains that don't work. I should correct myself on that. Just villains that just weren't the right mesh. Because for the original animated series, they very much did have a style that you really could only do so much with. That is the best way to put it. Because Bane was just, he was a stretch. He wasn't really something to where you could say, oh, well, there's this classic movie quality to him. Because classic movies were really what they were going for with each character. Even the concept of a character like Killer Croc is someone who is... He's more creature of the Black Lagoon than anything, especially in Vendetta, where you see him and he's just a monster dude. That's his entire shtick, is he's intelligent and he has a vendetta against Bullock. But at the same time, whenever he's presented, it's always like he just kind of appears out of water and you don't quite see what people are looking at until it's too late. And he's played very much like a classic universal monster. It doesn't really bode well for his other appearances, because once you reveal the monster, then it becomes kind of a punchline. And that leads to moments like,
I threw a rock at him.
Which is great and works tremendously well for Killer Croc, but at the same time, it's like the scare factor just goes away entirely, and they had to adapt with that character. Bane was never going to be that kind of a character because he didn't have enough material, first of all. He didn't have enough reference material in the comic books yet because he just did the one thing. Then Jean-Paul Valley came in and took him out, and that's where he was by the time that they went to production for the episode. However, a character that they really, really helped redefine in kind of the same way that they did Mr. Freeze, but to a lesser extent, because Mr. Freeze was by and large created from the ground up for the series. This character was less so, but she was given a certain level of gravitas that no character received in stark opposition to the character that was in the comic books, and that's Poison Ivy. Poison Ivy on the show was lovingly crafted. And I mean visually and in the writing, because visually she actually was one of the characters that wasn't designed by Bruce Timm. Bruce Timm went to design her, and as he explains it, he just kind of froze up and didn't know what to do because he wasn't confident enough in his stylization to do the women on the show. So he went to an artist named Lynn Naylor, who, taking a bit of inspiration from Will Eisner's The Spirit, crafted one of the single most softly crafted. She's everything about her is just petite and interestingly made for animation. It's weird how well she adapted to that.
She's like a wooden nymph.
Very much so. She's very ethereal and otherworldly in her design. And it made so much sense to me whenever I read that in your notes, because doing my rewatch, that was something that struck me in every one of those appearances by Poison Ivy. Is she doesn't look like she was drawn by Bruce Timm. She very much looks like a spirit femme fatale. She specifically with the Will Eisner nose she has, and that makes all the sense in the world now. And I think that that's also that's such a happy accident that Bruce Timm wasn't able to design her, because that makes Ivy stand out so much, because she just looks like she came from a completely different show. And it makes her seem like I said earlier, just so otherworldly.
And she's introduced in such a way that they never really go into her origins or anything like that. They don't really need to, because the character speaks as just a persona. They developed a persona off of the character that had been created in the comics, because Poison Ivy in the comic books had really, she had existed since the 60s and was an on-again, off-again presence, but she wasn't really kind of a femme fatale, per se. She was just kind of a gimmick villain. She was kind of the female equivalent to Louis the Lilac from the 60s series. Poison Ivy also was someone who had just been recently reinvented in the comics by Neil Gaiman, of all people, and given a completely new backstory. So she was this character that was just kind of there and ripe for reinterpretation. And when you see her original episode, it plays out like just this head turn of what a traditional noir would be like, because it's a episode where Harvey Dent is poisoned. And Batman goes to investigate, and it turns out that the beautiful woman that seems to be caring and compassionate and wants to see this through is actually a horrible plant-themed psychopath who wants the eradication of all men. And a lot of that came in just the direct approach of just, okay, let's treat them as if they have conditions as opposed to they just have gimmicks. Because that would also influence like later characters like Mad Hatter and stuff like that that would appear in the series and be completely reintroduced for the series, is that they wouldn't treat these characters as if, oh, well, they just do these things because it's kind of a pop thing to do in Gotham City, where you just come and you have a costume and some of them work better, some of them don't, and whichever ones work better is the one Batman's going to fight the most. These characters are treated as if they have specific psychological conditions, and Poison Ivy was, like, you can see it in the first outburst that she has in that episode. She has a specific mental illness in that she just doesn't see the world the same way that we do. She sees it as plants. Plants are her children. Literally so, because in an episode that would come later, she grows children from plants in one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen on a children's cartoon.
Oh, they wring so much genuine pathos out of Poison Ivy in this series. Like, she's really never once played as a villain you're really supposed to root for Batman to defeat. She always just feels like a very sick person who needs help, which is a very, like, a surprisingly mature take to see from a show that is only a couple of years after He-Man and Transformers.
And Poison Ivy also just helped usher in a lot of relationships that Batman would have with the various rogues gallery, because, of course, with the Joker, he has a lot less patience in terms of dealing with him, because he's just a loose cannon. He's a character that will do things for the sick perversion of wanting to inflict pain and wanting to inflict terror onto people. Like, the whole episode of Joker's Favor is about just how demented and how far Joker will go to make one person's life a living hell. And you have other characters that completely contrast that. Of course, you have Two-Face, who is sympathetic, but at the same time, he has just so many ugly qualities about him that you can't really root for him the same way. And Penguin is just such a kind of off-putting character visually and just emotionally, because he's just meant to represent nastiness masked as aristocracy.
I've always loved Paul Dini's thing with the Penguin, which is the tragedy is he's fat. If only someone would look past the fact that he is, in fact, the Penguin.
Well, but then he lost all that weight.
Exactly. That's why he's so happy in New Adventures.
Well, that's why he went legit. Then you also have characters that are treated very similarly to Ivy. And you can see that Ivy was just kind of a moment where they struck gold in the series, because as you move along throughout the episodes and more villains are introduced, you have more sympathetic characters coming through, like the aforementioned Mad Hatter. He's a character who had nothing in the comic books. He was just a dude who had an Alice in Wonderland gimmick. And then before that, he was just a dude who was obsessed with hats. That was literally his thing. And it evolved into, oh, well, he just believes that he's in this world. Paul Dini wrote the episode Mad as a Hatter, and he completely turns the idea of this really demented character on its head, because Jervis is just this really lonely guy who happens to find love in a woman named Alice. And because of that, all this inspiration kind of flows through, and he wants to present himself as the perfect ultimate person through mind control, but still.
I suppose you, like your friends, claim that Batman drove you to be a criminal?
He did.
And yet, as I recall your case, you brainwashed and kidnapped a woman who rejected you.
Batman forced me to do it. He was going to take her away from me. I had no choice.
You could have respected her wishes and left her alone.
I'd have killed her first!
It's really kind of tragic how so many of these characters just want the one thing. And because that's denied to them, they turn to crime and they blame the outside world for it. They blame society at large. They blame Batman himself for inflicting pain. Harley very much operates on that measure, where in Mad Love, she just is like, okay, the only thing that's ever gone wrong is Batman was always there and he was always coming between me and my puddin'. And it's so interesting to see the dichotomy of villains, because before that, they really weren't treated that way in the comic books. You had characters that were well-defined, like you had Joker, of course, you had Riddler to an extent, you had Catwoman, who had gone through so many reinterpretations at that point that you didn't even know who she was at some points. I don't think even she knew who she was at some points in the comics.
Am I a stewardess? I don't understand.
Catwoman in the show also is just a character that's just so interestingly played, because she's completely gray. Sometimes they flirt with the idea of her being morally gray, but in the show, they completely just say, okay, well, she also kind of has a sickness and that she's a thrill seeker and can't let that go, but it's much more subdued. And she's the closest to Batman that Batman will probably fight, because she's out for a good cause. And to kind of give credit where credit is due, that's all because of Sean Catherine Derrick, who, as we mentioned in the last episode, was a troublesome story editor that pretty much put the production on hold because she didn't agree with how Tim and Radomski were doing things. She influenced Catwoman in so many ways in that show, because she was an environmentalist. So was Selina Kyle. Like, she was an aristocrat, but at the same time, she was operating at night as kind of a Robin Hood type character. And that was all just developed in that first introductory two-parter of The Cat and the Claw, where Selina is less so the romantic interest and more just, you and I have a fun thing, but I have a larger goal in mind.
Wait, so her two contributions to this show were Batman needs to have a recycling bin in the Batcave and the entire character of Catwoman.
Yeah, it's diametrically opposed, because on one hand, really good idea. On the other hand, what?
Oh, they could have done it so Selina makes him get the recycling bin in the Batcave. It could have worked.
I just imagine Catwoman looking down at Batman, who's walking past a recycle bin and trash can next to each other, and Batman stops and he pauses and he stares at both of them, and then he throws his soda into the trash can, and Catwoman's just like, almost got him.
But yeah, I've always really appreciated that particular take on Catwoman, where she's less of a villainous femme fatale and more like, she's almost like a Diabolique, the Italian spy character. She's very much like a spy villain.
She's very much in the realm of femme fatale, but in a different way. It's in a way that's, I think, more interesting because Selina, of course, modern interpretations of Selina kind of vary because Brubaker made her into more of a vigilante type character who looked after her own and was more of a protector of a particular sect of Gotham City that no one else will want to protect.
And one of my favorite comic book runs of all time, by the way.
And then she went on to kind of go back into the thieving thing because Ed Brubaker didn't write Catwoman forever. So, of course, later writers would go on to just kind of make her the thief again. And
it turned out Zatanna messed with her brain. It was stupid. We don't talk about that.
And then there were other deviations from there, like when the New 52, she's a mob boss and like all this other weird stuff. But Catwoman in the animated series was just kind of the purest example of she's not just a thief, she's not just a criminal, she's not just a cat themed mastermind type character. She can be someone who is Batman's not only intellectual equal, but just she has a moral code of her own. I think the animated series was kind of the first one to hit on that specifically, because even Batman Returns, which did influence the animated series version of Catwoman, did kind of skewer more towards she's just kind of crazy. And the animated series very much portrays her as someone who just kind of has more of a problem than being all out crazy. She just has more of an addiction. And this take on Catwoman, I should say, proved so popular and such a hit with the fans that Warner Brothers was going to create a spinoff series for Catwoman.
What?
Now, there was a movie in development after Batman Returns. This has been reported by many, 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 many people over the years that Tim Burton was going to do sort of a spinoff based off of Batman Returns with Michelle Pfeiffer returning to the role. I think the same screenwriter was attached from Batman Returns. Mm-hmm. And they were going to do sort of a more femme fatale type thing with her. But seizing that opportunity, Fox Kids actually went to Bruce Timm and said, "We're thinking of potentially doing a Catwoman show. Could you draw up some designs for us?" And he was happy to oblige. He drew up this version of Selina that was the show's version of Selina, but in a black costume. Those are the designs from the series pitch that never went anywhere because the movie never went anywhere.
Well, I've seen those, and I always thought it was just like in-between art from the one style and the new one. I never knew that was for a Catwoman show.
A Catwoman show that just was going to be her globetrotting and was going to be more far-reaching than Batman, because it wasn't going to take place in Gotham at all. It was just going to be this thing where Selina kind of went out and just did Catwoman things, but all in different continents. It was going to be kind of like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? But not as a quiz show, as an actual serialized thing.
That's what I was thinking as you were describing it.
That sounds so cool.
And it didn't go through because there was no real follow-up on the movie. And at a certain point, they just kind of wanted to focus entirely on developing Batman, because little did they know that Tim had the capacity to do another show. They just thought, well, this would be too much to put on one team. So eventually the idea just kind of went to ruin and was abandoned. And that style did eventually influence the New Adventures version of Catwoman, but to a very loose degree. They kind of went in a different direction, which, again, I will talk about a little bit later.
That bothers me so much. They would have been printing money with that series. God, that would have made such an impact culturally.
I just want to see the intro.
I know.
I feel like a lot of saxophone music would have been used.
Oh, most definitely.
But yeah, that was a bit of a thing to where the stars just didn't align. And unfortunately so, because that version of Catwoman, I mean, Adrian Barbeau in that role was tailor-made to be that character. I mean, I think that's kind of why Adrian Barbeau was put on this earth, was to eventually be Catwoman.
And to seduce Swamp Thing. Those were her two biggest achievements.
And she did so magnificently in both categories.
Thanks for coming after me.
I owed you.
Well, I'd like to think our relationship isn't just restricted to saving each other from freaks and weirdos. And that maybe we'd have a place for each other without Gotham. Without the freaks. Maybe without masks.
Clayface I do want to touch upon, because that was also a big kind of turning point of the series, because this entire pitch, by the way, comes from Marv Wolfman, one of the most legendary writers in the business. He wrote Crisis on Infinite Earths, for God's sake. But Marv Wolfman came up with the concept of this character who was an actor who just had an affliction. And the affliction was he got into a car accident and was presented with this miracle cure by Roland Daggett, and then took so much of the stuff that he became this terrible clay monster. This was an allegory for drug addiction. It was a very clear allegory for drug addiction from the very get-go. It's played that way in Fate of Clay Part 1 and 2. It's just, this is the danger of addiction. And Clayface, because of that, comes across as one of the most human, inhuman monsters of the entire series run. It's kind of incredible when you look at that, because Ron Perlman, who voices Clayface, he's not putting on a tough guy performance. He's not putting on a performance that's strictly just, I'm a monster man. Rah. It's someone who is riddled with a life of pain and a life of torment because he can't be human. And I just find that to be such an amazingly well-crafted story for someone who, in the comic books, just jumped into a mystical pool to get his powers.
He comes across like an old universal monster villain, which I really love.
He's so pained and desperate.
A lot of the series episodes that dealt with Clayface were handled by Tokyo Movie Shinsho, which just went to town as far as doing the transformations. Like, that is still held, according to Bruce Timm, that's still held in regards to some of the finest Warner Brothers animation in history. Just that scene where he's constantly transforming into his prior roles in the second part and just can't control the transformation. He just keeps going from person to person to person. So he even turns into like an alien that kind of resembles Frieza from Dragon Ball Z. It's just so cool because he just brings out such creativity in that he can literally turn himself into anything.
The monster design to Clayface itself, like, he looks so good in animation.
And that's largely because of Tokyo Movie Shinsho just taking their time with this. Like, TMS is still, I mean, whenever Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and all of them talk about TMS in the commentaries, they still talk about them with such reverence. Like, they were among the upper echelon of animation studios that they worked with. I mean, so much so that along with Dong Yang, they were the secondary animation studio that they got for New Adventures. Like, they just came in and just knocked it out of the park pretty much every time that they came in to do something. So Clayface was just a masterful work all around because people just took that character so seriously when he was just originally, he was a movie actor who had a weird mask and terrorized like a movie theater.
Well, that's what I find kind of like accidentally beautiful is Clayface began as a takeoff on Lon Chaney. And by the time they got to Batman the Animated Series, he was a universal monster. It's like going back to his roots in a very non-direct way.
What are you doing? Stop it!
Look at them, Agent. Look at what you used to be.
No. No. Turn them off.
You can play those roles again, Hagen. Let me help you find a cure.
No! Hagen's gone! Make him stop haunting me!
Going off of that, I did want to tag up on, speaking in terms of Perlman's performance for this, I did want to talk about several other members of the cast, because we did talk a bit about Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill and Arlene Sorkin and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. We talked about the story where Tom Ruger actually convinced Bruce Timm and Eric Radomski to hire him after Clive Revel. I did want to bring up certain other actors who brought a lot to the roles that they were given, because Richard Mall as Two-Face is one of the greatest tragic performances in that entire run.
Oh, that's just what Two-Face sounds like.
Yep. He's just so definitive. And I mean, you could say the same about so many other actors. They cast the best possible actors for these roles like 99% of the time. Of course, there were other actors who didn't gel with the roles quite as well, and that's why they were recast for the New Adventures. Like, and nothing against Henry Pollack II, who was a great Scarecrow. He just never had a really good shot because, of course, he was the condom head in the first episode.
Ooh.
And then he was in Fear of Victory, which is just a weird episode. Like, going back, that's one of the lesser episodes of the
entire
series.
That's an odd episode.
He just runs around half the time as a Mr. Potato Head man.
He Scarecrow was kind of written fairly silly in the original animated series.
And the most impactful appearance of him is he's in shadow most of the time, because Dreams in Darkness is kind of his big episode where he becomes a formidable threat. And he's literally just kind of standing there leering and cackling for most of it until Batman stops his plan, and that's kind of it. So that character really never got to display Henry Pollack's acting chops, because he did have a lot to bring to the role. It's just by the time that New Adventures came around, he had retired from acting very briefly. I think he went back to it in 99, but by then they'd already done the New Adventures. So they brought in Jeffrey Combs, who is one of the most terrifying baritones I've ever heard in any cartoon.
Terrifying, aren't they?
What's going on?
That's what I'd like to know. Who are you? Why were you snooping around?
Easy, easy. I was just looking for some loose cash. I wasn't trying to move in on your operation. Whatever it is.
A thief. I thought as much.
Hey, be cool!
Scared you, didn't I?
His voice is the embodiment of fear.
That amazing design, and just, I just want that to be Scarecrow and everything.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Where he's just flat out just the skull cowboy from The Crow.
He really is. That's something that's ticked me off about Scarecrow a lot over the years, is every single artist draws Scarecrow completely different, because there's never really been that good of a look. And everyone's always married to the idea that, no, he literally has to be a Scarecrow because his name is Scarecrow. No, there's no way to make that work.
When they went to redesign him, what was really in their minds was the idea of decay, the idea of someone who just lives in a perpetual state of decay, because they had no interest in going back to, like, oh, here's Professor Jonathan Crane concocting fear toxins and all that, because that was kind of when everything kind of fell apart, when you would do a Scarecrow episode, is when you had to go to the Jonathan Crane parts of it. So they were so dedicated to doing this new version of the Scarecrow that they didn't even know if there was a dude under a mask. They didn't know if it was a mask. And that's what's so great about that design, is that you look at it and it's like he has the hangman noose. He has the farmer clothes that are just demented, and he has like a cane. It's so creepy and weird and hidden behind shadow. And he has a messed up face and teeth. And it's just, just even thinking about it is terrifying.
I love how they specifically designed him to look like the ghost of an old timey fire and brimstone preacher.
Oh, yeah. He was very much in the vein of, this is what Garth Ennis's version of Scarecrow would be. To the point where it's like, I kind of even balk at the fact that they were allowed to present that design on television.
I'm amazed they got away with the noose. Cartoon censors are very weird about nooses. They think that if a kid sees a noose in a cartoon, there'll be a sudden explosion of hangings.
And what's really, really fascinating, and one of my favorite things about that Scarecrow design specifically, is that, and we talk about that design with such reverence, and talk about Jeffrey Combs with such reverence and that appearance. I say appearance singular. He makes one appearance in the New Adventures. That's it. He has a cameo at the beginning of Over the Edge, but he's not even played by Combs in that. He just kind of has a dude doing the laugh. That episode is so impactful that you assume he's a part of the show just throughout that entire season. Like, he makes multiple appearances. He doesn't. He just has the one. But it's so well done and so well written. And it's so cool because that actual episode, Never Fear, is actually an inversion of Scarecrow's usual gimmick. He takes away fears, and that's the truly terrifying thing, because people without fear are actually more dangerous. Looking at you, Daredevil. But moving away from the Scarecrow, there's also just a lot of people on the cast that really fill out the roles beyond just the superheroes and the supervillains. Like, of course, Lauren Lester does a great job as Dick Grayson, who becomes Robin and becomes Nightwing. But you also have characters like Commissioner Gordon, who is really for the first time in this series being portrayed as kind of what he was in Year One, and all the subsequent, like, Frank Miller depictions, like even the curl is kind of reminiscent of how he was portrayed in The Dark Knight Returns. Gordon in the show is such a rock of just sanity in all the insanity that's happening around him. I think the portrayal of Gordon kind of cemented what Batman and Gordon's relationship would be, Because, of course, they had Year One to start as a benchmark, but they didn't really have this sort of comrade-in-arms type thing going on, because they were just, you know, Batman would show up and Gordon would give him, you know, details on a crime, and they were kind of chummy, but they weren't really friends. They weren't people who had deep mutual respect for each other, and that was what the series brought to that relationship. And it's really heralded by a great performance by Bob Hastings, who just could turn on a dime and go from delivering like a basic gruff cop type of performance to the performance that he does in Over the Edge, which is one of the most, he turns into Batman's worst enemy in that episode. And then you also have characters like Bullock, who I don't know how they managed to take a character like Harvey Bullock and make him feel as though he was always part of the Batman canon and always part of the Batman pantheon from 1939 onwards. But they do. They treat him as if this world crumbles if Harvey Bullock is not in it.
Yeah, that's right.
And Robert Costanzo, I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger's friend from Total Recall, manages to make just this lasting, like, kind of the nemesis of Batman in a lot of ways, the professional rival.
They sell you on both Bullock and Montoya so much that it was genuinely shocking whenever I grew up and realized they weren't just mainstays of the Batman universe since the 30s.
Because they brought him in to the show, they couldn't really do the corruption angle, but they did kind of flirt with it in Vendetta. They managed to make this character serve way more of a purpose and just kind of have all the mainstays, like the fact that he calls Commissioner Commission and refers to Batman as Vigilante.
The only thing that will get me to watch this latest season of Gotham is if Donald Logue looks at 14-year-old Batman in his weird Big Daddy mask and says, whoa, we got a vigilante here.
Because Batman the Animated Series made Harvey Bullock such a mainstay character, Donald Logue has had regular work since 2014.
Finally.
Bullock is a major live-action TV character because of Batman the Animated Series.
I mean, that's how far this show reaches, because, I mean, of course, we as fans have been majorly influenced by the show. I myself have been influenced by it in just an incalculable number of ways, but the show managed to leave such a lasting impact on Batman productions that would come after it. Even Batman and Robin has the Mr. Freeze origin that Paul Dini crafted. Weirdly, but still, it has it in there.
Yeah, what a weird backhanded compliment. It's like your child saying, look, I make breakfast in bed. Oh, no. I guess his heart was in the right place.
Stuff was just implanted here and there because the series just made that big of a splash and was that revolutionary in terms of how it would go on. And kind of is surprising to know then that the network was vehemently fighting Bruce Timm and Eric Radomski at pretty much every step of the way. This show was doing a lot of taboo things early on. I mean, there was even a story that Bruce Timm told where they were told that they were using the legal limit of black on like the legal limit of darkness in an actual show because they were doing the episodes on black paper.
I just like the idea of an executive saying it to Tim exactly like that. And I'm saying, exactly what do you mean by that phrasing, sir? Speak into my tape recorder.
You look at On Leather Wings, and there are entire segments of the screen that are completely blacked out because it's kind of faded off of the paper. And the lens is kind of dirty, so everything is just draped in shadow. The series has a very moody feel about it because everything, the visuals, has such a clout to it, and the way it kind of looks retro and the way it looks just, it's constantly at night, so it has to look as if it is believably at night. And Gotham City in that show is just a nightmarescape in a lot of ways because it's just something that comes from complete and total darkness, literally in the production angle, because Eric Radomski just came up with this revolutionary way to paint the backgrounds and do the character models, and they managed to just do something so radical that Fox Kids was like, whoa, don't make it that weird. Because
don't you be making some kind of show here now.
Because up until that point, they were used to like G.I. Joe and all that and He-Man. I mean, they were used to very simplistic style animation. They had no idea what they were doing when they gave the show a real budget to work with. Because That's another thing about the show that we really didn't touch on in the last episode. Batman the Animated Series had a humongous budget for an animated series. They had a budget of $6 million.
They had the money to employ Adrienne Barbeau gainfully.
And she had made love to Swamp Thing, so she was a huge get.
She had Creepshow money.
She was in Escape from New York. I'm just going to keep listing Adrienne Barbeau things until we run out.
We all have tremendous crushes on Adrienne Barbeau here on Graphic Novelism.
Well, how could we not?
Getting into some of the fights that they would get into with what they would call BS&P, they would regularly be the target of network censors. Some of the more outlandish requests included not being able to show animal excrement, leading to a scene of Alfred being hit by bat guano being cut from the original pilot.
That would have been very weird to see in an episode of Batman.
Yeah, that is true. But they also wouldn't allow Batman to punch anyone more than once. In fight scenes, he's just kind of, boom, you're down. That's kind of what they had to... And that was risque even for that, because Spider-Man couldn't do that in Spider-Man the Animated Series. To openly just palm someone and just punch them in the... Like, they weren't allowed to punch people in the face. Much less do anything. Like, body shots were fine. He could punch them in, like, I don't know, the arms or something. Like, I don't know what Fox was
so
going
mean.
For. I don't know if what Fox was going for with that request, but they could not do a flat out just he punches someone in the face.
I like
for
how
the longest time.
I like how freakishly strong that made Batman too. He punches you in the gut and then you just fly against a wall and you're dead.
Scarface wasn't allowed to call anyone scumbag. Harley wasn't allowed to be called a nutcase or a screwball to avoid offending anyone with mental disabilities. Catwoman wasn't allowed to land on her face or breasts when falling.
Well, I'm glad for her.
Why? I can understand her face. Like, what was the concern? Like, did they think, oh, if we don't put down the law right now, they'll just have her boob collapsing every episode?
They didn't want her, Selena has implants. They didn't want it animated them bursting in any way.
Oh, God. That can get very dangerous very fast, I understand.
Penguin had a line about dropping the soap in prison that was cut entirely from Almost Got Him.
That one I kind of understand.
Batman was also, and this is really weird when you watch the episode, Batman was forbidden from saying, oh my God, in the original script for Heart of Ice, as Fox was terrified of offending Christian families by showing a Batman who would take the Lord's name in vain. The line, to appease them, the line was then simply changed to, my God, somehow earning approval.
It's the same thing.
It just gets rid of, oh, that's it. But one of the crowning achievements of the team in terms of their fights with the censors was there was a line in the original script for Perchance to Dream that was written with the intent of deliberately making the censors go nuts. Which is, remember the line that Batman has whenever he realizes that it's all a dream and Mad Hatter warns him of jumping off the tower because he doesn't know whether or not he's going to survive. And he turns around and says, like, I'll see you in your nightmares. That was originally, I'll see you in hell. I want to know if there is an actual recorded instance of Kevin Conroy as Bruce Wayne screaming, I'll see you in hell.
What I love is, could you imagine if the censors were just asleep at the wheel that day and that got through?
It would have been kind of amazing. Consequently, I should probably mention that whenever the show was revived at Kids WB for the new Batman Adventures, network censors were very lax after the multiple Emmy wins and acclaim that the series had generated. So they basically said, you can do whatever you want.
As we saw with Leather Boy. That's Bruce Timm's version of stretching and putting his feet up on the couch. I'm finally somewhere where I can really spread my wings.
But going into sort of, because I mentioned the fact that it won Emmys, Batman the Animated Series actually won quite a number of awards during its run. The series premiered in 1992, but it won the 1993 Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Animated Program. It won the 1993 Daytime Emmy for Outstanding Writing in an Animated Program for Heart of Ice, and the 1996 Daytime Emmy for Outstanding Musical Direction and Composition and Outstanding Sound Editing. It was also nominated for a number of other awards during its initial run, including 9 Daytime Emmys, 7 Annie Awards for Mark Hamill, Bruce Timm, Eric Radomski, Paul Dini, and Shirley Walker, 1 Saturn Award, and a Young Artist Award for one of the bit players in the House and Garden episode, I guess one of the sons of Poison Ivy. And then Mask of the Phantasm came in and nearly won Best Animated Feature at the Annie Awards. Problem is that that was the same year that The Lion King came out, so it wasn't going to win. But going off of, I think at this point, we've just kind of talked ad nauseum about what the series was during its production run. That original run lasted technically 2 seasons, though it was split into 3 for the DVD sets because there were so many episodes produced that you could just do that. The series officially ended in 1995 at the height of its popularity. It was still, it made the move from Fox Kids, which was just dwindling and kind of a dead network at that point, into repeats on Cartoon Network, which was this huge marketing push. There's a poster actually that James sent us earlier today that has the line Yabba Dabba Doom on it, which is a direct reference to Youngblood.
I was so confused to find that.
But the series just kind of lived as just, for a couple of years, it lived as this thing that was just, it was a game changer. Everyone knew the minute that it aired that it was this game changer that would live on as a classic that for all time we would look towards and kind of look at with awe. And then it was just kind of, as far as the production people went, it was just kind of forgotten about because they had other projects that were lining up. Eric Radomski actually left Warner Brothers Animation in 1996 to go to HBO and work on their animation department, and he happened to work on a little animated program called Spawn.
Whoa, I never knew he was involved with that. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, Spawn the Animated Series. I don't know in what capacity, because unfortunately the actual credits for him are kind of within the show itself and aren't really listed on like IMDb or anything. He's kind of listed as like associate editor or some sort of weird credit like that. But he was heavily involved with HBO Animation's department. Whenever he would come back to more traditional superhero fare, he would actually go on to Marvel and do their actually current crop of animated shows, which is kind of fascinating in and of itself. But whenever the series order came in for Superman, in 1995, 1996, they completely invested themselves in doing that. And there was really no thought whatsoever of doing Batman until 1997 was about to roll around and Batman and Robin was going to be a thing. Kids WB came to Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and Alan Burnett and Glenn Murakami, who had kind of taken over Eric Radomski's position, and said, hey, we want you to do more Batman episodes. Could you maybe hammer something out? So originally, the show, which was called Batman Gotham Knights, was basically a team-up show. It was kind of like a prototypical version of Brave and the Bold, where it was sort of meant to be a sidekick showcase more than anything, because one of the big things going into it was Bruce Timm really wanted Batgirl to be a permanent member of the team so that they could tie into the movie more. And
yeah, that's why.
I know, but
Ken Bane joined the team. No.
But in the original series pitch for it, and you can see this in images if you look it up, the series was decided to take place about 3 years after the original Batman Animated Series was produced. So you had Batman, you had Robin, who was not Dick Grayson, but was in fact Tim Drake, who was decided to be Tim Drake because they couldn't do Jason Todd on behalf of the fact that Jason Todd comes with an expectation of eventually being killed off.
It's the Gwen Stacy paradox.
But Tim Drake was around in the comics. He was the current Robin at the time that they were doing the show. So they decided, okay, well, we like the Jason Todd character and origin, but we also really like elements of Tim Drake. So they just kind of combined the two and made their version of the Kid Robin. Because if you'll recall, Fox Kids had a strict thing about showing children being endangered, Well, Kids WB didn't care at all. They were like, oh, throw him into bullets. That's okay.
That's how we make our livings.
So Tim Drake was made into Robin. Of course, because of this, Dick Grayson had to move on to become Nightwing. And the way that they went about designing him for that show is fascinating, because they knew that simply putting him in the Nightwing costume but keeping the design the same wasn't going to work, because he just looked like Robin cosplaying. So they had to change up his hairstyle. Nightwing had been introduced in the 90s with a mullet, so they were like, huh. And that's basically where Nightwing's design came from, is the costume was too simplistic to kind of work on its own, so they had to change up Dick physically as well. They had to give him the mullet to differentiate him from the Dick Grayson style from the animated series as much as possible.
Could you imagine if they used the same logic when doing Superman, the animated series? This is what 90s Superman looks like.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because in the Batman Adventures comic, they did a version of Superman before they ever did Superman, the animated series, that had the mullet. Like, you could totally look up issues of the Batman Adventures where Superman appears on the cover and he just has this giant, just freaking, it's like Fabio hair. It's weird.
I'm sorry, Bruce. I was trying something out that summer.
But going from Nightwing, they also, you know, they redesigned Batgirl because they found her design to be kind of repetitive when compared to Batman's, because Batgirl had been introduced very late into the series, and because of that, they didn't really have a lot of time to work on her design, so they basically gave her a design that was like, okay, she's the girl version of Batman. That included the gray bodysuit, the cape that was black and blue, like all that kind of stuff. So for this one, they just kind of made it to where her design was more reminiscent of the early comics, of the Silver Age comics, and you very much see that in her color scheme, where it's like all black, but it has blue highlights and yellow.
And it pops very well.
It does. I actually really like the way that Batgirl appears on that show in terms of just the visual. I think that's just something that is one of their better designs. But there was a fifth member of the Batman team. And unsurprisingly, this would come at the behest of Howard the Duck's creator, Steve Gerber. The Creeper was to be a permanent member of Batman's team.
How would that have worked?
I don't know, but it was vetoed very quickly, because even Bruce Timm was like, no!
Would he have lived with them?
Can you imagine, like, Jack Ryder just hanging out in the Batcave, like, talking to Alfred and just swinging off of poles and stuff because he was the wild, wacky man?
I just imagine. Confound
it all, Creeper. Get out of my recycling bin.
I just imagine Alfred Dustig, and he just looks over, and Creeper is just standing there, staring at him, smiling. Hey! And then Alfred just turns and goes back to dusting.
I'm fascinated by the fact that Tim vetoed that, because I always assumed that was just a product of Tim's personal obsession with the Creeper. But yeah, if you go back and watch the Creeper episode, the thing that's the most fascinating about that is that's just what Freakazoid was supposed to be. Yeah, because Tim worked very briefly on Freakazoid whenever it was still in its super early stages, and was immediately dissatisfied with it because the showrunners just wanted to do Freakazoid, but Tim wanted to do an actual superhero cartoon that just happened to have a slapstick comedy-based hero. So that dissatisfaction, he kind of very disgruntledly decided, okay, I'm going to do my Freakazoid and do it on Batman. That's how we got Beware the Creeper.
Coincidentally, written by Steve Gerber.
But once again, how would that have worked? Could you imagine Freakazoid, but he still fights real villains and it's a real show?
And Candlejack is a legitimate psychopath. But it's funny you mentioned Freakazoid, because that kind of circles around to our big opener from the last episode, because guess who developed Freakazoid? Tom Ruger. So literally, he's just off just creating the rest of WB animation during the 90s while they do the superhero stuff. But going back to the creation of the New Adventures, one of the interesting things about that show is that the idea of doing what they did with the animated series didn't really appeal to them, because they had thought that they had basically done everything that they had set out to do with the Batman character. With the mini-movie setup and all of that, they didn't really want to tell stories that were more grand and epic in that same exact way, so they approached it in a more humanistic way. They wanted to tell human stories. They wanted to tell stories that were more of a naturalistic tone in a weird way, because they weren't dealing with the same Dark Deco type world where everything was heightened to the nth degree. They were doing a show that was a complement, essentially, to Superman the Animated Series.
Oh, Gotham, it's far more in that tone. Yeah.
Gotham was still a city that existed in the Art Deco world, but was much more streamlined and much more just toned down. And the show that they wanted to make was essentially just a Batman show that was, ironically enough, more like the comic books themselves, just something that could eventually have something like No Man's Land happen within that continuity and not be out of place, as opposed to where it would be completely out of place in Batman Animated Series.
A world that could possibly contain a Leather Boy Bane.
And Firefly. Firefly, I've gone out of my way not to criticize a lot of elements of the show because I have a lot of reverence in my heart, but boy, is Firefly just a character that, even by Bruce Timm's admission, just sucked. He just had the one thing.
I mean, that's pretty much Firefly.
He had a fire lightsaber.
Which doesn't make any sense.
It really doesn't. It really, really does. Like, Bruce Timm spends the entirety of the Legends of the Dark Knight episode making fun of Firefly and how, what were we thinking when we made him the episode's villain? But going into something that I know is going to interest you, Mike, we've talked about the design process for a couple different characters, but we haven't really talked about one of the more infamous ones, which is the Joker, and why they redesigned the Joker the way they did. And the answer is both simple, but at the same time, very, very confusing, because Bruce Timm basically, he went about designing most of the major characters himself, and he wanted to do it in the more streamlined style that he had developed for Superman the Animated Series. So with Batman, you had a character who, because of the friction between him and Robin going off to become Nightwing, Batman was basically in a state of depression whenever he went into the show because he had lost kind of the color of his outfit. So he literally has a costume that is just nothing but blacks and grays. And that's where the pouch belt comes in and all that sort of stuff. And he's a bit like more bulky because he's older. The Joker was given a 1940s skeleton man concept as a basis.
I can see this.
And what I mean by that is 1940s cartoon skeleton basis. He wanted him to appear as if living death.
Looking at him now, yeah, he looks like he's about to dance around a terrified Betty Boop.
Yeah.
It has that very same quality. And also, in terms of his costume, of course, the original Joker for the original animated series was based a lot on Jack Nicholson's costume from the 1989 film. So he had the orange and the blue tie. So they wanted to make a Joker that had the pure green and purple color scheme. So they gave him a big bow tie and had him wear the green shirt and the purple suit. But the thing that everyone goes back to is the eyes. Why are the eyes so weird looking? That's why. They had the design idea of this 1940s cartoon, like what James said, kind of a Betty Boop type character, where he was more fanciful, but at the same time, more terrifying. And of course, knowing Tim's logic now of terrifying equals Leather Boy, you have very weird concepts that come out of that, like the Joker just having absence of eyes except for like tiny little white irises, and Killer Croc being just a lizard man. Because that was a thing too, is just Killer Croc in the original animated series was designed to be a reptile man, a nondescript reptile man. He had one of the unsung heroes of the animated series was a comic book artist by the name of Kevin Nolan. And Kevin Nolan had been contacted. This is all from a 13th Dimension article that had come out in celebration of the 25th anniversary. But Kevin Nolan was originally contacted based off his work in Secret Origins of Man-Bat. It was Secret Origins 39 from 1989, where Kevin Nolan drew this really simplistically styled version of all the Batman characters. So Bruce Timm looked at that and said, I want this guy to help me design these characters because we need to simplify them for animation. So he came up with a number of designs, including Alfred and Ubu and Scarface and couple of others that really didn't make it in. Like, he drew more of a Jack Burnley-style original Dick Sprang Penguin that didn't really make it into the series at the time because, of course, Batman Returns was a thing. And so Kevin Nolan designed this version of Killer Croc that is 100% his own. You just see his sketch for Killer Croc, and it's like, oh, they didn't change a thing. And that original version really works because he's just this kind of pale gray-skinned looking dude who has just more of a skin condition about him and just this weird jawline that kind of goes down to an angle. For the new adventures, they just decided,
he's an alligator man.
He's the lizard, essentially, without a tail or a lab coat.
Like, between seasons, did he fall into a vat of radioactive waste?
He just...
This is all your fault, Bullock!
Just doesn't really land as well, because it's just, the more you subdue something, the more it just kind of flies flat on the actual screen. So that was a design that also just kind of didn't work. Another design was, I know exactly what image is conjured in your mind when I mention this character, Mr. Freeze.
With his weird absence of eyes.
Mr. Freeze's design had a bit more of a glaring problem. They had a story idea for an episode called Cold Comfort, which would be the sequel episode to Batman Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero, which effectively ended Mr. Freeze's storyline. It was a storyline where he finally managed to cure Nora. And so he kind of, it's this kind of beautiful moment in an otherwise just kind of decent film where at the end of it, he hears the newscast of Nora Freeze being, you know, cured finally, cries a single tear and just walks off into the snow. And that's just the end. But they knew that that couldn't be the end because it's a Batman reprisal show. Like, because they were doing new adventures and because they didn't know they were going to be doing new adventures, a lot of episode ideas just kind of came to them in desperation in terms of, okay, we have this character idea that was kind of pitched for the original show, but what if we used it for this? Essentially, Cold Comfort has Mr. Freeze have his condition worsened to the point where he has to lose his entire body and is placed on top of spider legs, robot spider legs.
Yeah, this isn't the version designed by Mike Mignola.
No. Mm-mm. Mike Mignola somehow managed to dial it back because Mike Mignola was the guy who designed the original Mr. Freeze suit. He was the guy who developed the ones with all the tubing that you associate with the Mr. Freeze character now. It's just kind of ingrained into the DNA of him. And Bruce Timm basically took that design and streamlined it for the actual show. But then whenever it came to doing the actual show, he kind of based the design for Mr. Freeze on just kind of a automobile. He basically wanted to make him more like robotic. But there was the glaring problem of that episode also making him a robot Spider-Man. So that was a thing. And Cold Comfort is a great episode. I actually really like it up until that reveal, because then it just kind of gets wacky.
It's pretty silly.
And you can't get over the visual of him just kind of crawling on the all fours while still being a head inside of a bubble.
Oh, this is probably my least favorite episode of Batman the Animated Series, despite the fact that there are many that are objectively worse. But this just ruined the character of Mr. Freeze for absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
Even beyond his design, the plot of this episode is Mr. Freeze just wants to kill everybody now, including Nora, because she had a different husband.
His whole modus operandi is that he kills the things that everyone loves. The episode opens with him killing it like a painting that's been painted over like 2 decades by this artist and saying, now you know how it feels to lose everything you worked hard for. And basically, he just turns into one giant emo.
It's like a less interesting version of that one issue of, I think, Gotham Knights or something, where he's walking through the park talking about summer and killing people.
Yeah.
Except this version, he's really, really generic.
And this version would have to be retconned so hard that it would take Batman Beyond to finally wrap his story up in a way that meant something.
It took 80 years for Mr. Freeze to be created.
He had to sit in that fridge and think about what he did.
And he was still a detached head. Like, they had to give him an entirely new body through future science to undo the mistake of that. Because they set it up to where he could return, but he never returned. Mr. Freeze was just kind of one of those where they took the concept as far as they could, and then they overdid it. So they had to fix it again. one of the characters that kind of did benefit overall from the redesign era was, like we mentioned earlier, the Penguin, who is just one of the most genius versions I have ever seen. Like, he's just everything that the comic book Penguin wanted to be so bad in the 90s, because that's where this came from, this idea of this nobleman, this aristocrat version of the Penguin who works on the side of the law but does things underhanded, as opposed to being a weird, wacky umbrella man.
This version who romances Roxy Rocket.
The version that is played in the New Adventures is so insanely cool because he's just a 1940s gangster who has the air of aristocracy, but is still, like, he's played by the same actor, Paul Williams, who does an amazing job. Like, one of my favorite villains upon my rewatch of the series was Paul Williams as the Penguin. He was just so, he had an air of just, I believe I'm better than literally all of you, but at the same time, I have a sadness to me because I know I'm a Birdman. He kind of evoked that through his vocals, and I don't know how you do that. But in this series, he just gets to play the gentleman who, in the actual Roxy Rocket episode, which is The Ultimate Thrill, which is a great episode, he has this moment where instead of just using a trick umbrella, he just has a machine gun hidden in a trash bin. And all he does is just pop it out and just start firing a Tommy gun at Batman. So it's like this really cool character who, for the most part, appears to be legitimate, but at the same time has this hair trigger where he can just immediately go into, I will kill anyone who tries to take over my operation type.
I just want to run a nightclub, you bastard.
It's just the Kingpin, but on a much, much lesser scale. So all the characters in this, I mean, they managed to, for better or for worse, just kind of continue the evolution of what they used to be and provide just sort of interesting, I think, nuanced takes on everything. Because a lot of people debate, is the New Adventures as good as Batman the Animated Series? Is it even, can it even be considered on the same level? And for me, it always is just, it's all one show. It's just, it's the Animated Series and it's the New Adventures, and they're just, they're intertwined.
Also, were you going to bring up Poison Ivy's redesign at all?
Poison Ivy's redesign was basically out of a necessity to make her appear as if her disease, or her mutation rather, was getting worse. And basically they went in with the idea of, we want to make her look more corpse-like, but at the same time retain beauty. So they just made her skin just completely drained white.
Now, this is easily my favorite Poison Ivy design out of anything.
Same.
Like, I'm mad when I pick up a comic with Poison Ivy in it and she's flesh toned. It's like, no, damn it, she's green.
Exactly.
That's her costume.
It's interesting because it's a simple need to kind of take that design from the original series and just do something different with it. And at the same time, it's something that just comes out of a character basis. It's the idea of her being so far gone in terms of, like, her plant state that she is physically taking a toll. Like, it was even suggested at one point, I think, that she was actually dying as the show went along, but they never outright addressed that or anything. They never really got the chance, because the New Adventures of Batman was just kind of, the thing that you have to remember when talking about the New Adventures of Batman is that this was ordered while Superman was still going. Superman, I think, was in season 2 whenever the New Adventures of Batman premiered, or at the end of season 1. And they did World's Finest, of course, which was the big epic crossover and everything that you want a Batman and Superman story to be. And they were doing both shows simultaneously. And towards the end of Batman's run, they came to Tim and Deeney and Burnett and said, can you do a kids Batman show as well? And out of that came Batman Beyond. So there was a time where they were working on 3 shows at the same time.
Jesus.
And because of that, New Adventures only got 20 episodes. It was a full season order, but at the same time, it was the smallest season order that they could pull off. And it's really kind of a miracle they even pulled that off. So talking about just what they couldn't do, I mean, we talked about the Riddler and how they just could never figure out a story for him. I'm sure had they been allowed to do a second season, they would have rectified that in some way, but they didn't have the time. They just had to do with what they had. And that version of Poison Ivy is kind of, that's where that comes from, essentially, is the idea that okay, we have all these ideas for how her mutation is affecting her, but we can only show it in the design. We can't really show it in the story, because in the stories that she was present for, it's usually she's kind of incidental to the plot, and she's kind of a big reveal. But anyway, that was also kind of what led to Catwoman's design, because Catwoman, of course, was designed mostly off of the rejected series pitch that was going to be a Catwoman show. Now, they took this even further by having her don a one-piece black suit and face paint to resemble the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland.
But that's what's going on there?
Yep.
Really? Like that? Really?
It never occurred to me she was wearing face paint. I thought she was just gray for no particular reason.
Yeah, I thought it was just bad coloring, to be honest.
No. There are actually, in episodes with Catwoman, there are scenes with Selina Kyle and she has normal flesh tone.
I thought that was just like a design decision.
I always thought it was like an animation flaw myself, because it was just this thing that was just like never addressed at all. But it was just meant to be, it was intentional on her part, and it was just meant to be the Cheshire Cat. Which makes it interesting, because Mad Hatter was really never, he was used once, but it was in a Superman episode. And
He's very, very short.
He made a cameo appearance in Over the Edge when he's on the television show stating that he's going to sue Batman along with Harley and Riddler. His design is actually interesting because he's meant to appear more derelict because he's meant to reflect the physical toll that being an arch criminal has taken on somebody. So he appears as a homeless dude.
The hell?
I just like that being Mad Hatter's thing specifically. Look at the toll being the Mad Hatter has taken on this poor human soul.
All those hats really weighed him down.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like he has suffered being the Mad Hatter so much that he'd sized down to like 4.5 feet tall.
Got spina bifida or something? The hell? I was really hoping for an explanation for that one. I'm just mad and confused.
The teeth, I understand, but where did his spine go?
The Mad Hatter was just one of those unfortunate, just casualty. A lot like the Riddler, where he was just like, this is a design. This is this version. He just kind of put through a production cycle and just kind of pushed out there. And still voiced by Roddy McDowell. It was so weird. But, The New Adventures, I mean, it had its place, and it was definitely considered a staple of the overall DC animated universe, which is what would come out of all this. It was still kind of, a lot of people overlook it, and I think unfairly, because it's such a, it created some of the better episodes of the entire run to me. Not only do you have Over the Edge, but you also have episodes like Ultimate Thrill and Legends of the Dark Knight, which pays homage to the Dick Sprang, Kane, Bill Finger version of Batman, and The Dark Knight Returns for the first time in animation. Like that blew my mind the first time I saw it. And you also have just great episodes, like Growing Pains is one of the saddest episodes of anything I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Especially if you know the twist.
Here's the thing. Whenever I was a kid and this show started airing, we couldn't really get WB in my town. Like, the signal was very, very weak. So one day I was at a friend's house who had cable. I flipped over to the WB and saw Growing Pains. And I didn't know that there was a Batman show still on. So I was like, what the hell is this? And it was that episode, and I was confused and devastated.
The episode is very, very devastating. I can't even get it. I got through it this time, but it's just one of those things where I was like, it's just so sad. It's like a Joe Dante movie from the early 90s.
You were telling me the other day you had almost the exact same experience.
Yeah, Growing Pains was an episode that I believe I was at my grandmother's house, and I was just flipping the channels trying to find something to watch, and it was like a Saturday morning. And I turned it to Kids WB and did kind of a double take, because Batman was there, but he looked different and acted different. And Robin was much shorter and completely voiced by someone else. And Clayface was there. And it was this whole thing of like, wait, I can't compute. Because one thing that not a lot of people realize about the show is that the new Batman Adventures originally wasn't even its own show. It was a companion piece to the Batman Superman Adventures, which was a block that Kids WB ordered that made it impossible for the new Batman Adventures to get its own introductory title sequence, which is why it was called Batman Gotham Knights, because nobody really had a title for it. And eventually it became known as the new Batman Adventures simply because it was part of this block called the Batman Superman Adventures. So this was very low key, especially for a Batman project, which you would think they would go all out to promote. But no, it just kind of landed in all of our laps.
And it didn't even occur to me for the longest time after seeing that was a continuation of Batman the Animated Series. I just thought, since so much time had passed, this was just a new Batman show.
And when you watch the show, it's even kind of interesting how Kevin Conroy's voice kind of sounds more hardened than it does, because he had been doing the character for so long that his voice actually changed over the course of the original animated series. If you listen to his early episodes, like even Bruce Timm says this, like, he sounds very weird because he's still learning how to play the character. By the end of the run, he knows how to play the character. By the new adventures, he has the voice that he's had ever since. And that voice is what would go on to drive the Arkham games and stuff like that. And he just kind of sounds, it has an overall different quality that you can't really explain, because it's Kevin Conroy, but it's also not. It's kind of like a refined version of him. But New Adventures has its place as just its own thing, and really is seen as just, I think, more of a novelty than anything else, because it was so drastically redesigned and so drastically of its own kind of feel and take, because they were trying to tell different stories that a lot of people just kind of consider it its own show. And I feel like to talk about Batman the Animated Series, you also had to talk about New Adventures, because it is so closely linked in such a great continuation that keeps the feel and the maturity of that original show alive. And then you have to remember that the maturity of the animated series was nothing compared to its first theatrical outing, which I would be remiss not to at least mention, which is Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Oh yeah, we're going to at some point down the road do an entire separate series just on animated superhero movies, because that's going to be an epic undertaking. But yeah, we've got to talk a little bit about one of the finest pieces of animation in movie history.
One of the finest pieces of animation, one of the best Batman stories ever told in comics or otherwise, one of the best, I mean, a lot of people consider it the best Batman movie there's ever been made, and with good reason. It's a noir epic of proportions that really should not have been there, considering that originally Batman Mask of the Phantasm was ordered to be a direct-to-video movie. And when the production team was told this, that they had the chance to work on a movie, they were like, oh, cool, we'll get to do this and we'll have plenty of time and we'll have like 2 years of production time to do this. Paul Dini, Alan Burnett, and Bruce Timm were on tour for the Japanese premiere of Batman the Animated Series whenever they learned that Kids WB and Warner Brothers had changed their minds and decided to make it a theatrical event that was to be released that Christmas. They had 8 months to deliver what usually takes over 2 years.
They had less time than Bryan Singer had to direct X-Men.
And by some miracle, including the fact that one of the writers of this was mugged and horribly beaten to the point of having to have his entire cranium basically reconstructed from scratch, this movie came about. Originally, it was called Batman Masks, and it was going to... A lot of people make the common mistake. I made this mistake for many years of saying that, oh, this is a loose adaptation of Year 2. Alan Burnett and Bruce Timm both have denied this for several years, and nobody was paying attention to that. Their idea for this was, we want to just tell a love story. We want to tell a love story and make it tragic, to tell more of a humanistic Batman story that goes back to his origin and tells all these different facets of like how he came to be the man he is. Year 2 was entirely coincidental, down to the Phantasm character, who you could see as an analog for the Reaper, but in actuality, and this is going to sound really weird, the inspiration for the Phantasm, as written by Alan Burnett, who came up with the story, was she was originally meant to be a knockoff on Mysterio.
Everything always comes back to Mysterio.
That actually does make sense. The smoke is a dead giveaway.
Yeah,
the smoke, that was the thing that she, that was kind of the gimmick that Burnett leaned into because he thought it was a great visual that could be translated very well to animation. And the reason that she looks like the Grim Reaper is because Bruce Timm kind of sat down to design her as the most extreme analog of Batman imaginable, like literally a Grim Reaper of crime, because they had to make the subplot of Batman being mistaken for the Phantasm believable. So they had to design the Phantasm to kind of evoke Batman's imagery, but be different enough to be its own thing. So what's closest enough to this person who wears a cape and a cowl, if not someone who's also draped in their own cloak, but kind of has just another motif entirely about them? And that was just kind of settled on the Grim Reaper. It had nothing to do with the Reaper. They didn't even know the Reaper existed at the time.
Okay, I believe that wholeheartedly because it's Batman Year 2. So yeah, I can see them having no idea that story even existed.
Yeah, Year 2, for those who don't know, W. Barr actually wrote this story, and it's just not very good. It's got an interesting concept, and that's about it. It's really a story that reads as just something that really wouldn't make a very good Batman animated movie. So it's kind of weird in retrospect to think of it as a loose adaptation of Year 2, because you would have to think that Bruce Timm and Alan Burnett had a reverence for Year 2 and this great respect for Year 2 when it's really not a good story.
It doesn't even make a good Batman comic.
It says something that the greatest claim to fame Year 2 has is being mistaken as the inspiration for Mask of the Phantasm.
Oh, Reaper.
But it's also interesting to kind of look at the writing process for this as well, because Paul Dini, again, was mugged, so he wasn't really a part of the writing process for a while. He was originally slated to write the whole thing with Burnett. He couldn't do that because of the mugging, so they brought in Michael Reeves and Martin Pascal, and each one of the writers tackled a different segment of the film. Like, they kind of traded off acts of it, where Alan Burnett wrote the entire opening and the whole number with Phantasm attacking Chucky Saul, and it goes right up until the first meeting between Bruce and Andrea, and Martin Pascal is actually the one who wrote a lot of those scenes. He does a magnificent job of just crafting this character that you immediately like and want to see more of in Andrea Beaumont. And then from there, Michael Reeves kind of takes over and does the middle portion. It's not until the Joker appears that you really get Paul Dini's stamp on the whole thing, because Paul Dini had been going through this huge bout of depression for months and months and months. This is all detailed in A True Batman Story. And he wasn't really able to muster up anything to write for the movie until he finally, in a medically induced haze, decided to write the Joker scene, the introductory Joker scene.
And if that explains a lot.
And if you look at that scene, yeah, it is a very, very medically induced written scene.
I hate that song. Gasp! Can it be old Sally the Weezer Valestra? Welcome, Pison. It's been a dog's age.
Hello, Joker. Didn't mean to drop by unannounced.
Oh, Salvatore, why so formal? Mi casa nostra es su casa nostra. So, what's an old-timer like you want with a two-timer like me?
Business. I got...
Ooh, business sounds like fun. Come, we'll repair the more comfortable environment. Now hold on to your hat and watch those valuables. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Maybe the Joker's putting his wiener in a robot. How about that? In the future.
Yeah, like he wanted it to be in the ruins of the World's Fair, which they had shown very optimistically earlier in the film. And he had a robot wife who originally was supposed to have this long extended fight sequence with the Phantasm. And that's actually seen on a traded card, but they had to pass that up. But all of that aside, Batman the Mask of the Phantasm ended up becoming the grandiose top of the line piece of Batman media that you would need to absorb to know everything about the character if you didn't have the time to watch the entire animated series, because it boils Batman down to his essentials and gets to the very soul of the character in a way that I've never been able to properly enunciate even for my own thoughts. I still can't articulate what that movie means to me. So it'll be very interesting to talk about that later on down the line whenever we do get to that animated movies segment of graphic novelism. But between recording episodes and talking about our love for the animated series and talking about the many facets that went into creating the animated series, something tragic actually did happen in real life. For various reasons, recording the second part of this was delayed for a couple of weeks, and we're now just getting back in the saddle. But as of the day before we're recording this, we found out that Lane Wayne, who actually wrote a couple of episodes, he wrote the Demon's Quest Part 2 for Dennis O'Neill. He actually, unexpectedly, at the age of 69, passed away. Details are very scarce on it. There's nothing really known about it. But his legacy, not only just the Batman the Animated Series, but the comics in general, is immeasurable. And as someone who knows a lot more about this than I do, I want to pass the microphone a bit to Mike on this, because he has a few words he wants to say.
Len Wein's death is rough. And, I mean, besides the fact he was only 69, he was very young. We, of course, as I said, don't know the cause of death yet. But I think if you talk about influential, and Len Wein is one of the most influential figures in the history of the comic book medium, and no one says it. And I think that's something that's bothered me with his death, is a lot of people are kind of coming out and saying it now, but it's still not as, you know, it's Len Wein. This is a guy, to quote something Neil Gaiman said, I think either yesterday or just earlier today, he showed me that comics could be literature. Len Wein, very early on, when he began writing comics at just the age of 20, took comic books, superhero comics, anything that he wrote, to a higher degree. And he saw something else that could be there. I mean, if there's a comic book Mount Rushmore, he's on it. He's on it with Stan, he's on it with Jack, he's on with all those guys. Influential doesn't even begin to describe Len Wein. I mean, as an editor, he's honestly even more important than the likes of Julie Schwartz. And look how important Julie Schwartz is to the creation of modern DC comics and comics. He has the rare ability to write kick-ass pieces of work and be a kick-ass editor and help cheerlead comics into that modern age. He had his handprints all over the 70s mainstream horror comic revival, which one day maybe we'll touch on a little bit more, but was a big deal. And he did it on both sides of the street, both Marvel and DC. Of course, co-creating Swamp Thing with the unfortunately also taken far too soon Bernie Wrightson. But he also even contributed to Man-Thing. He, almost right away, I think, issue 2 of Man-Thing. We wouldn't have Whoever Knows Fear Burns without Len Wein. Like, that's a dude who created two amazing, amazing horror characters. As an editor, not only things like Watchmen, Len Wein is almost entirely 100% responsible for the British invasion of comics in the 1980s. And he's more responsible for the X-Men being the X-Men that is today than he'll honestly ever be given credit for. It's nice to see him being given credit now, but few have had their hands in as many characters and in as many facets of the industry as Len Wein. Few have history like Len Wein. Few kept their spirit up like Len Wein. He was always out there being a cheerleader for the medium. He was always wearing still his geek shirt or his hat or both. And he was out there preaching the power of comic book storytelling and how magical and important it is right up until the end. And you don't see that much. You don't see that spirit remain, that excitement, that just pure joy of being a fan, never jaded. And you see even less of the old timers who can still bring it as a writer. Len Wein could still write. And as we have experienced with various, old-timey comic book writers, that doesn't happen. They all fall off quality-wise. Lin-Wei could still write a goddamn comic. And to quote somebody else, this time Chris Claremont, who said, the history of modern comics would be incredibly different if you took Len Wein's contribution out of the mix. The fact he doesn't get credit for it half the time is disgraceful. Truer words have never been said. Len Wein is one of the biggest contributors to comics being what they are, to us being comic book fans. The things he touched just in the background as an editor changed everything. And I don't know what the landscape would be without Len Wein coming in. Without Len Wein and Marv Wolfman taking those weekly DC comic offices tours and shoving their work in everybody's faces to try to get in, and we got Len Wein out of it. We are incredibly lucky as comic book fans that we got to experience what he did for the medium we love.
And on that incredibly profound note, where we go from something that has really stand the test of time as an adaptation for the medium and stand as one of the best adaptations for the medium, to someone who literally gave us the medium, I think that's really no less fitting of a note to end our big retrospective on, because if you can really boil down Batman the Animated Series, Batman the Animated Series was the Len Wein of animation. Animation, as it exists now, would not exist with the same cadence as it does without Batman the Animated Series. Batman the Animated Series gave us a set of storytelling tropes and a set of storytelling guidelines that Len Wein really brought to comics. And he's the reason that we have such seriously minded storytelling in comic books. I mean, he's the reason that we have characters that are treated so seriously, because the fans treat them so seriously. And that's really what influenced Batman the Animated Series the most, was the idea that these weren't silly characters. These were characters that, to all of us, meant something very deep and very profound. And that was the first show to get that and really take it home and really make that the foundation for everything that it became. So for 25 years, we have lived with an incredible gift in this show. And it is people like Len Wein that made that possible, because I can't think of what comics as its current form would even be without either of those elements. And Len Wein, I mean, God rest his soul, is just somebody that we'll be talking about for the rest of our lives. So to know that he even played a small part in the show is amazing, and really just helps legitimize it even more, because its legacy will live on forever and his legacy will similarly live on. Like, when you think of comic books, they will be intertwined. So on that note, I think it's a good time to bring this to a close in our retrospective for Batman the Animated Series, because whenever we set about doing Challenge of the Super Toons, we said to ourselves, we gotta save at least one big one to go out on, because the other shows have a lot of great charm. The other shows have some not so great charms, but ultimately they all build to a single narrative and a single picture of what we were trying to convey throughout this entire series, which is cartoons matter. They're a medium that actually brings legitimacy to these characters, sometimes even more than the films or the video games or even the comics themselves. They transcend sometimes and become even more, because they kind of take everything that was built upon in the foundation and perfect it. And that is definitely what Batman the Animated Series did. It perfected it. So on that note, for this episode of Graphic Novelism, I've been Arrest Krakos.
I have been Jammin' James Lewis.
And I've been Maniacal Mike Napier.
will come to order. The Legion of Pulp is now in session. In a moment, iTunes... Yes, Quizmotron?
I was wondering, Emperor Palpatine, if I could perhaps...
Box Office Pulp thinks we need a few items to pawn on the black market.
Box Office Pulp Guy, you have a podcast dedicated to movie analysis. Pinhead, your pleasure puzzles are deadly. Isaac, you've got gone.
Gone?
What more do you need?
Almost a nuclear warhead.
What?
All other supervillains have them. With a nuclear warhead, I shall leave all of the podcasts to tear themselves apart with paranoia.
Box Office Pope wants a magic lasso to hang himself with.
Can I get a ship in a bottle, Git?
I demand more corn.
To make my own ship in a bottle.
Oh, enough of this. The hell do I look like, Santa Claus? We're wasting valuable time. Right now, my Pope drones are rewriting Apple's code to make our podcast number one on iTunes.
Excuse me, Emperor.
Quizmotron, what is it?
All Quizmotron wants is pants. A decent pair of pants.
Darth Vader wants pants, too.
Order! Order!
The guilty pleasure of planet is insignificant.
Pain is not supposed to be this complicated.
Tune in next week at popepodcastnetwork.wordpress.com.
I don't even know how I deal with any of you on a daily basis.
Ah, hello there. I didn't hear you come in. My name is Cody Elft, but you've come to hear about the next dynamic podcast from the Pulp Podcast Network. I haven't personally listened to this new podcast, but as its producer, I am contractually obligated to inform you about how gosh darn fantastic it is. And boy is it. In life, the great hero Hercules faced 12 labors. He fought the Nemean Lion, the Lernaean Hydra, the Cerberus, the Hellhound of Hades. He stole the girdle from Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons. He even traded barbs with an animated James Woods, and his sucker punched the mighty Thor in the face. But now, he faces a greater challenge than all of those tests combined into one giant ball of challenge. Now, Herc must face off against his most challenging foe in Pulp Podcast Network's thrilling new show,
Hercules versus the Podcast.
Hercules possessed a strength the world had never seen.
Oh, Hercules, Hercules, Hercules,
what's
Hercules?
Hercules,
deliver us from this curse.
Hercules,
strongest man alive.
No man is superior to Hercules.